Greetings, fans of Doctor Who podcasts. We have an important message
that we'd like to share with you. We've all been moved by recent events.
The survivors at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School are using their voices
to speak out for those who cannot,
to say never again,
and demand change.
We are asking the Doctor Who community to follow their example and to shine a light on this urgent issue.
This March, representatives of all your favorite Doctor Who podcasts and some special guests will be coming together to do a podcast commentary of a beloved classic series story.
What that story is? Well, that would be telling.
But here's the thing. We're not putting out this podcast on any one show's feed.
We're only releasing it to listeners who provide a donation to an organization committed to ending gun violence.
Here's what you have to do. Make a donation of $10 or more to
March for Our Lives or
the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence
or Moms Demand Action. These organizations are U.S.-based
and focused on changing American laws and policy.
They welcome international donations.
However, if you live outside the U.S. and want to donate to an organization in your own country,
you can find some suggestions at realitybombpodcast.com/whoagainstguns.
If you send a copy of your receipt to GallifreyStands@realitybombpodcast.com, you'll get information on where to download your special commentary podcast later in March.
You can find more details at realitybombpodcast.com/whoagainstguns.
The Doctor has implored us to be kind, and in 2018, amplifying a good cause
is one way that we can be kind to each other and our world.
So let's get involved.
So let's get involved.
So let's get involved.
So let's get involved.
And be kind.
We have a logo,
a Yorkshire accent,
new Target novelizations,
and 4 interviews from Gallifrey One.
For February 27th,
this is This Week in Time Travel.
All right, this is Chip. I'm here in Durham, which is on the East Coast, which is far, far away from several hundred of my closest friends, and that makes me very, very sad. Are you joining me in my sorrow, Alyssa?
No, because I am still in sunny Los Angeles, for which I apologize both for the fact that I am basking in the warmth and for the fact that I could not bring my mic on this trip. And so I am recording on my phone. So let's hope the audio quality isn't terrible.
This podcast is over.
Dang it.
We're going to be bringing you 4 interviews this week in time travel. We're talking to Jenny Colgan, Haley Neubauer, Alyssa Stern, who puts together the wonderful Dr. Puppet videos, and Rona Monroe, who wrote for the classic and the new series. Lots of stuff to look forward to in this episode. Alyssa is the primary interviewer. I was just the tech monkey. If you listen really closely, you will hear me ask one single question sort of floating in there like a pop-up troll or something. I don't know.
But literally none of this would happen without him. So be very grateful that he was sitting to the side making us all sound good.
So that's coming up later in the podcast, but there is some news of the week that we wanted to get to.
Delightfully, yes. We finally got to see the new logo for Doctor Who, along with an incredible introductory video and new iconic images of Jodie Whittaker's Doctor. And oh my God, it is so good.
It's very different. And the point that Stephen Moffat made a couple of times at the Gallifrey One convention and that we've been hearing pretty consistently and that we talked about a bit last week with the new visual effects group that's being brought in, Doctor Who looks new. It looks like a reboot. Not a reboot, but just the part of that periodic refreshing that happens. And this logo is so different from everything that's come before. It's just delightful. And I mean everything that's come before.
Absolutely. It is bold. It is distinctive. It is still within my similar frame of reference for the show, and yet feels like nothing I've ever seen before. That video showing the TARDIS actually shooting through the logo is incredible. Breaking through, you see the shards of the red rock splitting away from it. Dare I say, it looks like she is breaking through a glass ceiling. It is just an incredible logo, and it looks brilliant, and it's just a good harbinger of what's to come.
I'm not sure exactly what you'd call the secondary logo that they released. You know, back in when Stephen Moffat started, there was a so-called Dwardis logo with the D and the W next to each other in a shape resembling a TARDIS. Similarly, the BBC's released a new sort of mini logo, a circle figure with the word Who inside it that we presume we're going to see in social media avatars and things like that, something that fits very well in the square. And that looks really cool, too.
It does. I think the whole branding effort came together really well, and all of their updated social media profiles look really interesting and, you know, cohesive together, which is great to see the design team working so well on that. So hats off to you. You all did amazing.
We've got some more poster style artwork as well, with Jodie Whittaker silhouetted in the dark with her coat being all swoopy and her Doc Martens or whatever boots those are that she's wearing just very pronounced. And in the distance, the TARDIS. It looks really good. Really, really good.
We also got some additional new views of Jodie Whittaker this past week. No spoilers, so you don't have to worry about setting your phone aside really quickly. Just seeing some new videos of Jodie Whittaker interacting with fans who are coming to watch her film the new series on location shoots. And she has just been an utter delight when she has been meeting with those fans. And it is something pretty wonderful to hear her say, "I'm Jodie, I'm the Doctor."
She's got it down. She's got it down. One of the things that fascinates me about this point in time right now is, as more location shooting happens and we're going to see more examples, you know, they can't just keep her locked away in the studio forever, and they're not going to be able to just lay down a security blanket and prevent anybody from seeing her at work. But she is delightful in the interactions that we're seeing of her. Love the stuff that the BBC put out when they were at the BBC Worldwide Showcase and they were pitching the show. She was photographed next to all of the 13th Doctor fan art on the wall. Just looked really good. So they're getting it all right, and she feels like the Doctor. And we don't know the first thing about the 13th Doctor.
Nope, but we do know that she is brilliant.
That we do. That's the future. Let's take a quick dip into the past. A big surprise announcement came out this week that nobody knew a thing about, and it's just blown everybody away. And that is, there are actually going to be BBC Books Target novelization style releases of adaptations of new series episodes. I'm blown away. Who knew?
I am drowning in your sarcasm right now, Chip. Absolutely drowning in it.
Covers were released for The Christmas Invasion, adapted and written by Jenny Colgan. Rose, adapted and written by Russell T. Davis. And The Day of the Doctor, written and adapted by Stephen Moffat. And those covers look amazing.
They do. We also have two new Target novelizations coming out. Paul Cornell is going to be adapting Twice Upon a Time. So if you think you've ever been under deadline, imagine seeing Twice Upon a Time in December and writing the adaptation novelization that needs to come out in April. We also have James Goss adapting Douglas Adams' City of Death to the Target novelization form. So we've got some new episodes and also some older ones that are getting novelized.
Yeah. James Goss previously released a novelization of City of Death, but there's going to be some sort of adaptation that he is making, or I'm not entirely sure. It's going to be somewhat different. It's still going to be substantially his work, but it's somehow going to be fitting into the Target format.
new stuff, new ways of reading old stories. I love it.
Yep. And finally, Elizabeth Sladen, Sarah Jane, such an important part of the Doctor Who legacy. And her series, The Sarah Jane Adventures, is reemerging in its entirety for free on the BBC iPlayer if you're in the UK. And so that's wonderful. For American viewers, we've had it on Amazon Prime. We just had to pay for the service. BBC viewers can now get it for free with their, well, for free with their license fee. So when we come back, we will have those interviews with Jenny Colgan, Haley Neubauer, Elisa Stern, and Rona Monroe. This week on The Incomparable Network.
If it's bad 1950s science fiction starring John Carradine, it must be a rocket surgery episode of The Incomparable. Episode 395 takes on 1959's The Cosmic Man.
Our friends from the Hockey Feels podcast invade The Incomparable's own hockey podcast for a Las Vegas crossover special on Beginner's Puck.
And spoiler alert, Chip does not fare well on random trivia between a bunch of Doctor Who fans on episode 81 of Game Show. Mind the explicit tag.
All this and more at theincomparable.com.
We are here with Jenny Colgan, a Doctor Who writer who has written novels, short stories, and Big Finish audios. And on top of all of that, is also a best-selling romantic comedy author. Jenny, thank you for joining us on This Week in Time Travel.
Oh, it's brilliant to be here. Very busy place, and yeah, a lot of fun.
Wonderful. So you write for a variety of different mediums. What are the challenges or joys of working with each one, and do you have a favorite that you really enjoy working in?
I am a novelist by trade. That's my job. So I can find the audio is quite challenging because, you know, you do have to be careful not to have people just walk around pointing at stuff and going, hey, what's that, Doctor? So it's challenging but fun in its own way. And obviously hearing the actors do your work is very exciting. That's a real thrill. It kind of depends what kind of mood I'm in, really.
Yeah. So you used to go by the pen name J.T. Colgan earlier in your career. What sort of influenced you to make that decision to use that pen name and then go to your real name?
Well, it's actually, the answer is actually quite boring, which is that my other publishers, who aren't connected to the BBC or Big Finish, have spent 20 years building up my brand as Jenny Colgan. It's horrible, isn't it? To talk about yourself in that way. But anyway, they were quite concerned that people didn't accidentally buy a Doctor Who book thinking that it might be about a woman learning how to bake. So that was kind of behind the motivation there. And then they kind of saw it and they're like, nah, you're fine. We still use the T, though. The T is still... I don't have a middle name. Yes. So it's in... out of respect to Russell is that we have... Because Russell does not have a middle name.
The standard Doctor Who non-existent middle name, just
yeah,
the
yeah,
letter
I like
T.
It. I like this like, kind of tiny tradition of two people that do that.
Yeah. So there's sort of an imagined tension between the genres of science fiction and romantic comedy, sort of seen by, you know, your publishers being worried about mixing the brands and people getting confused. But there's a lot of romantic comedy that's in science fiction. You know, there's a lot of that type of comedy in, for example, the relationship between the 10th Doctor and Donna. You see a lot of those dynamics. Sort of what do you think about how those genres actually kind of merge together more often than people might think?
I don't think they're separate genres.
Yeah.
I don't believe that sci-fi is a genre. I think romance is.
Yes.
But I think sci-fi is a setting. Mm-hmm. And actually what you're always looking for is where the emotions are coming from and the kind of story you want to tell. Where it is set is a lot less important. I think Ten and Donna have it's not a flirtatious relationship, so I wouldn't put it in the bracket of romantic comedy. I'd put it there more like siblings. But certainly when I'm writing for Rose and Ten, then there's a fairly constant undercurrent there. Mm-hmm. So if you think of something like in the Satan Pit, where Rose is on at him to get a mortgage, I mean, that's a brilliantly romantic comedy trope that just happens to come up there.
Exactly. Them trying to get the relationship together. So a lot of quote, professional Doctor Who creators see themselves as both fans and pros. And for some of those creators, it's a bit more of a complicated mix of seeing themselves more as one or the other. How easy is it for you to be both
seen as a professional and a fan in this area.
Oh, you couldn't do it if you weren't a fan. You know, you couldn't. You have, one, the money's rubbish. And two, like, for example, I was asked to do some Blake 7, which was a show that I had really, really liked and was fervently keen on when I was younger. But I didn't have the encyclopedic knowledge, you know, of every single twist and turn. You know, I've been asked to do spin-offs of other shows. And I, you know, and if you don't love it, then you wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, is that my agent? It drives my agent bananas.
Because you're always in to go, yes, I would like to write more of this thing that I love.
Yeah. She's like, why don't you write this thing? This well-paying thing.
So you have a couple of upcoming projects. The first, which I'm very excited about, is you're doing the Target novelization for The Christmas Invasion.
Oh.
What's the process like for writing a novelization of the episode?
Oh, my God, it's so much easier than writing it. Oh, the joy of it. So I got I had the transcript from the episode, I had the shooting script, and I had the first draft script, all of which were very different. And I kind of played, you know, amongst them and took what I liked and then built the world up a little more. But, oh, my God, and it's such a brilliant episode. So there's nothing in terms of, you know, tension or excitement that you have to do. Russell's done it all.
Right.
He was brilliant. So I was constantly asking him stuff. And then he'd write back, oh, that is a great line, isn't it? Yes, yes, it is, Russell. It's a really good one. And we just had a... And meanwhile, he was simultaneously writing Rose. He was so sweet. He's like, oh, I've never written a novel before. I'm like, yes, that's right. I'm going to give you advice, genius of the generation. So we were simultaneously working and we had really, it was just great fun. Except I had a real hard time with the character, if you remember, the bearded Welsh chap.
Yes.
Who dies quite early on, is called Llewellyn. Mm-hmm. Now, when you type for a drama, they use a program called Final Draft, where you put in the first letter of the character and the character's name appears for you on the screen. That's how the system works. But when you're writing a novel, you don't. You have to type out everything. Llewellyn is the crappiest word to type. Type, just imagine in your head doing it 198 times because I ran a find replace.
Oh no.
In fact, I should have, now I'm thinking about it, I should have just written Lou and then done a find replace. Don't. Anyway, so I had issues with him about that. And then the other fun thing, which was really was fun, is in this script, the tenant, of course, is wearing pajamas and it kind of goes very Arthur Dent, and that is absolutely fine. To see somebody looks like a thing is fine, but I wanted to expand a little bit and I wanted to talk about basically that it goes on, you know, it says this would have I think in the book he says very in this show he says very nice man,
yes,
and in the book I go on and say, well, this would have really surprised Arthur if he'd heard it, because every time they had met previously, the Doctor would be totally uninterested in killing all Vulgans and would just reminisce with Ford Prefect. Because Ford Prefect, of course, is a Time Lord. He's just a really lazy Time Lord, but he's canon Time Lord. And says I. And they were at college together with Zaphod. And that's all they do, and, you know, just get drunk. And so we had quite a lot of kerfuffle with that, and they were so nice. And I was trying to Google the Douglas Adams estate because I knew I would have to talk to them.
Right.
The problem is you can't find out who the agency is that does his estate, because if you Google Douglas Adams estate agency, you just get Hot Black Design. It's 5 pages of nothing else but that particular result. So anyway, the estate, in fact, were really, really good, and we sent them everything, and we said, we'd love to do this, and Russell kind of chimed in. He said, yes, Ford Prefect is patently a bad Time Lord. And so that was really a very, you know, it was full of moments of joy.
Oh, my goodness. This sounds like just an absolute riot to be able to put
it
together.
It was. The one stupid thing I did was, I don't know how I managed to forget, but I had a scene post-regen but pre-opening sequence, and for some reason, despite the fact that I'd seen it about 4 times, I forgot about the Children in Need minisode, that they'd already written that. So I wrote this really somber, horrifying, anguished couple of scenes where she's, you know, convinced it's a monster and that something's eaten him, and I don't use a pronoun, I use it, you know, for quite a long time. And pronouns, by the way, can let me tell you, for BBC fiction writers, suddenly got a lot harder.
I'm sure.
Right? Working on the TV series is now very, very easy. Our job is slightly more difficult. Yes, basically I'd written this, what I consider to be a very beautiful, upsetting piece of work, and then totally remembered that they'd written it already.
Oh, no!
And in fact, the one they've written is really funny. It's all about hopping and, you know, an A, I'm not ginger and stuff like that. So, yes, I feel I should add my tragic bit as an appendix.
I feel like we really need this now. Like, it just needs to exist somewhere that people can read it.
Yes.
You also have a short story coming out in the collection, The Day She Saved the Doctor, about the companions. Can you tell us anything about that story?
Yeah, I really wanted to write Chris, in fact. Although it's a Rose-centred story, I had never written Chris. So I've written Peter, Matt, David and Peter Davison, but I'd never... Yeah, I just wanted to write Chris, and there's not a lot of Chris fiction. There's not a lot,
right.
And of course he doesn't do Big Finish, so there's a very few opportunities, so I just kind of ran at it. Said, oh, who do you think?
This is mine.
Yeah, and because also everyone assumes if you're going to write Rose, you're going to want to write 10.
Right.
But, you know, I write 10 a lot, which is... I'm not complaining about that, but I really want to write 9. And then, oh my goodness, I found it really quite difficult. He says... a lot less than any subsequent doctor. He doesn't really give a lot of big speeches. He's grumpy, but not in a Peter Capaldi way, just in a slightly moody way. And as I always do in these circumstances, I said to Russell, please help me. And he said, it's the boots. It's all in the boots. All he does, he stomps around and every frustration he has. So it's
very much
a boot-based
yeah. Well, we're very much looking forward to reading that. That comes out in the States on March 8th. So that a friend has already promised me that as a birthday present, so I'm waiting eagerly for it.
Okay.
So, Jenny, thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Time Travel.
You're very welcome.
We are here with Hayley Neubauer, the costume designer for Doctor Who. Hayley, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's quite fun to be doing this.
So this is your first time at Gallifrey One, right?
It's my first time at any convention with Doctor Who, so it's been a really eye-opening, wonderful, amazing experience.
That's fantastic. Well, how have you been enjoying it so far?
It's we've just been sitting down talking about how an amazing weekend we've had. Like, I've never been to a convention like this before, and I really didn't know what to expect. But I'm amazed by the sense of community, like how friendly everyone is. You see all the different age groups, you know, 55 years of Doctor Who and as fans of every age group, and there's lots of babies and young children and people of all ages and older people, and everyone's just talking to each other. It's very relaxed, and you feel like you've made a whole bunch of new friends. It's been a really amazing experience.
I'm glad that it's been such a good experience for you. What's it been like to be seeing people cosplaying the costumes that you designed around the con?
I've never seen that before in person at all. It was, I think the first one was we were just coming out of the lifts the other morning, and we walked past someone who was cosplaying the ghost from the 2016 Christmas special. And I didn't sort of notice because I was looking the other way. And then my partner, Darren, pointed and said, hey, look. And I saw the guy just walking off in the other direction. I actually chased after him to get my photo with him because it was my first time ever in person seeing someone cosplaying something I'd designed. And it was really exciting.
That's fantastic. One of the things I've been very interested in hearing in your panels is how collaborative the costume design process is for Doctor Who, that you're working with people who are designing props, prosthetics, creature events. It's such a special effect heavy show that there's so much that has to work with and around the costumes that you're designing. Can you tell us a little more about what that collaborative process has been like working on Doctor Who, designing those costumes?
Sure. On Doctor Who, I think it is quite different to a lot of other shows because, speaking practically, the resources are tight. So we have to do so much of it ourselves. And it does vary hugely from script to script on Doctor Who, what the expectations are, unlike other shows which might all be set in the one period or the one universe where they have repeated use of the same kind of monster or prosthetics. Every episode is different with Doctor Who. And so the process is that when we get the script, we all sit down and it's like dividing up shares for who gets to do which bit. If there's this monster or creature, Millennium FX might do the head and hands or the skin, or they might do the whole creature head to toe, or it might be me doing the whole thing head to toe if it's the space suit or something. It really varies so much from one episode to another. It just depends what the thing is and what it needs to do and how we achieve that. What is the way we can get the best possible result? And we all talk about it honestly and practically together. And people, I think, do that well without a sense of ego, because everybody's on the same page of knowing we've got limited time and money and people to be able to achieve this. How can we get the best result for this episode? And who can do that? So we all have to take turns stepping up and taking extra workload, or stepping back and knowing that this time it's going to be better if another person does it to get the best result.
So when you're designing a costume, it seems like half of the process, especially when you have a new character, is actually building out the character. You talked in an earlier panel about how when you were designing Pearl Mackey's costume, that you and her talked about what type of music Bill might like as sort of a starting point for building that. Is that a process that you find challenging or exciting, to be able to really build the costume? And what's that collaboration like with the writers and the actors who inhabit those roles?
I think, again, it varies hugely from character to script to project, but I think that process where you work with the actor and the director and look at other interests that the character might have, it's much more pertinent to when you're doing contemporary costume, where the nuances are much more particular and readable by the audience. So if you're doing something in that's set in the 17th century, you know, it doesn't really matter to the audience whether the character is, you know, into one classical composer or another, or whether they prefer to attend chamber music or opera. That's not going to come across in the costume. But if you're doing something contemporary, what type of jeans you use, the style you use, might be indicative of a certain subculture, and then we straight away read by that style a little bit about that person. So it's much more important to fine-tune details about what that person likes and doesn't like. I don't always get to work with the writers. Usually by the time I'm on board, the script is written, it's been given to me. Sometimes I'm lucky to have a chat with them and try and get the understanding and the context of how what they were trying to depict, who that person is. Usually the person I have the most conversation with is the director, or the executive producer in the case of a TV series, not a film, as to how they see that character and what other references we might include. But for me personally, I always find music is, for contemporary characters and just 20th century characters, it's a really good starting place, because that tells us so much about, you know, what excites that person, who they see themselves as, who else they might hang out with, how that might influence them and their way of dress. Music, I think, is a really, really big factor, and it's something I like to also then get into and put on and listen to music that maybe I might not listen to normally, to try and get myself into the right space for considering options and ideas for that character.
So for the last series of Doctor Who, you had a lot of legacy characters and costumes coming in. You had new versions of Capaldi's costume to do new versions of Missy's costume. And then you had John Sims' Master coming back for the first time. And the Master, of course, has this very long costuming history to work with. Do you enjoy building off that? Do you find that there's good opportunities to be able to work within that history and put your own spin on the characters' costumes?
Yeah, it's always interesting, because sometimes when you start with a new character, a blank canvas, sometimes that's harder, because where do you start? You don't already have certain parameters in place that help guide you. So when you have a legacy character, there's so much information about it already for you to look at and consider, and it helps inform you. It doesn't mean you have to necessarily follow that exactly. You might consider not where the character's been, but where the character is now or where they're going, to inform you more about the design. But it helps point you in the right direction. There's sort of markers on the way, so to speak. And then I think after that, you've got to proceed with a degree of humility, and you can't be self-indulgent and have a huge amount of ego, because a legacy character is something that so many people know and they love, and you've got to serve them and the story with that continuity in mind a lot of the time. Even if you step away from it, you've got to have really sensible reasons for doing it. It's not just about coming up with an awesome design that you personally love. It's got to be right above all, or as a costume designer, you failed. So I think it's with that consciousness and being very careful and sensibly humble about it that you try and proceed. I mean, I have to say, out of all of those ones that you mentioned that came back in Series 10, I think probably the one that required the most thought and time was the Doctor, even though he's always been there. He's never really stepped away out of the show, obviously. I was working with Peter, who'd already done two series, and he had such a strong identity of who the Doctor was and how not just he played the Doctor, but what he needed to feel the Doctor to play him.
Yeah.
And that was such a subjective thing, and also varied hugely on the kind of story. Not saying that Peter's perspective varied, but how he felt he was representing the Doctor's feelings and direction. It was so subtle. It took a lot of effort to try, and conversations with Peter, a lot of time to try and get myself in his headspace. When he would say that he felt a look was too soft for the Doctor for this episode, I had to understand, what did he mean by soft? Did he mean the knitwear is soft and draped? Did he mean that this particular coat had too much movement in it? Was it too soft? Or did he mean that the whole thing felt too fragile and it felt too comfortable, and he needed something that was more aggressive in the costume and sharper and more tailored and contrasting? It's not just understanding whether they like it or they don't like it and what they do like. It's understanding the specific and very subtle context of what the words mean to them and what they're trying to express. Because if I don't understand what they want and like, I can't include it properly. And sometimes an actor comes to me with an idea and says, this is how I feel in this scene, how I think my character is, how I think they wear, and you think that's perfect, that's great, and it's me taking direction from them. Other times they might come with an idea and I go away and think about it and think, I see what you're saying and I understand you, but in this instance I think maybe we should consider this other thing because for whatever reason. So it is very collaborative, particularly when, like, Peter has played the Doctor for two series before me joining the show. You've got to take their information on board because he knows it better than me. He'd been doing it longer. So I tried really hard to get on the same page as him, and once I felt that I was there, started bringing in new options to say, you know, so considering what you've said, here's some things that match with that, here's some things that step away from it, here's some other directions, here's some things we can include. What do you think? And we were constantly, every week, trying new things. I mean, there was rails and rails of clothing left over at the studios from past series and also from series 10 of things that we had made, dyed, tried for Peter's Doctor, and then decided, no, this isn't right, let's not use it. And it sounds quite wasteful, but it's only by going through that process of considering things that you might not have otherwise considered that you then think maybe we won't include it, or maybe we will, just to explore the idea a bit.
So what do you think was the most challenging outfit for the past series that you're really proud to have pulled off?
That's a hard one. I think the spacesuits were definitely the moment that nearly broke me, episode yeah. 5, and my team. We were supposed to have 2 weeks off in October that year, but we worked 7 days a week around the clock to make that dozen spacesuits. They were very technical. Some of the cast, we only got their measurements days before the shoot, and the spacesuits, they were incredibly difficult with the construction because the kind of materials we're using, what they needed to achieve, the wiring, also making them fit the people well so they could wear them day in, day out, because they were very, very heavy. There was one actor actually that had a bit of a sore neck from wearing one, so we had to be really careful to get that right, and that particular costume had the most R&D to try and you know, tease out all the problems and make it work, and then churn them out and get them all ready and on camera at the time. We were exhausted, but while it was the most difficult technically to achieve, also when we stepped on set and we had the scenes in the corridors and all the lights flickering in the helmets and things working, it was also incredibly rewarding. So I suppose it's like any great challenge. It's difficult, but when it works out and it pays off, it feels fantastic to see it happen.
And they looked amazing on screen.
Thank you.
Hayley, thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Time Travel, and we look forward to seeing more of your work very soon.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
And we're here with Alisa Stern, the creator of Dr. Puppet. Alisa, welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
So this is your first time at Galley, right?
Yes, it is. Never been here before. Always wanted to. So glad I bit the bullet and came this year, finally.
Good. How are you enjoying it so far?
It's amazing. It's such a good convention. I'm having a blast.
Wonderful. So we're here. You've got two of your puppets with you right now,
yeah.
12 and 13.
I do. There's some more in the bag, but these are the stars for sure.
Yes, the stars of this convention. So tell us a little bit about your process for making the puppets. How long does it take to make each one?
Each puppet takes a few weeks. Sometimes those few weeks are spread out over months. I mean, They take a few days to make, but it's a very spread out process. So 13, I started making her back in October, I think, or even before, within a week or two of when she was announced. When was that? September?
Maybe that seems right to me. Yeah.
I started making her head because that part doesn't change generally. The actor's face shape is going to be the same. So first thing I do is I do some sketching to figure out the face, because that's the most important thing. And my puppets they're very simple in design, so I have to kind of nail every detail, like what the actor or actress's jaw shape is, and the shape of their ears, and the ratio of like height to width of their face. So that's the kind of detail I figure out. So I made that then, and then I made her wig, even though her hair might have changed, but I went ahead and made the wig. Didn't change too much, luckily. Kind of put her on hold. Didn't make the costume until a few weeks ago.
As you started getting more details about what it officially looked like.
That's right. And I jumped in a little early because when I knew I was coming to Galley, I'm like, I can't show up at Galley without the costume. This needs to happen. I'm like, okay, we have one good promo photo. Then we have some of the magazine photos, which are good. They show a little more detail. We know it has a hood, but we still don't know what the back looks like. So I was like kind of stressing out over like making it, but I'm like, let's just guess. It's fine. I'll guess. And then, of course, just last week, some set photos leaked of the back. Yeah. Luckily, I was pretty close, so I don't have to change anything.
I heard one of the cosplayers talking about how she was staying up all night to change the back of her coat.
Yes, I met that cosplayer earlier. I was complimenting her. I was like, how did you get the back right? And
a lot of sleepless nights go into these last-minute details.
Sure is worth it, though, isn't it?
Yep. So animation, it's a pretty time-intensive way of creating the type of work that you do.
Yeah.
Give us some perspective. How long, say, does creating 30 minutes, 30, not 30 seconds.
30 minutes.
Oh, God, that would be a long time. 30 seconds of one of your animations take.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I think there is about 30 minutes of Dr. Puppet content at this point, and it's taken us 6 years to make. So 30 seconds, that still could take a month. So animation is generally 12 frames a second. So that's what we're working with. So with stop motion, that means you have to move the puppet and take 12 separate photos for 1 second. So on a good day, we'll get 10 seconds maybe.
Wow.
So I know, 10 whole seconds of animation in a day. So at the end of a week, if we're very, very productive, we could have a minute. It really, for us, because myself and the team I work with, because Dr. Puppet is, I am the creator, but it is a group project at this point. So the two main animators, Aaron and Rachel, who work with me and do most of the animation on it, all have jobs. Like, we're all professional animators. So maybe, they can only devote a Saturday or a couple hours on a weeknight. So that is what makes it take so long. But, 12 frames a second, it's going to take a long time no matter what. But that's just the nature of animation. But, we love it. We're crazy.
It seems to have particularly paid off because your work has been embraced so wholeheartedly by the BBC and the whole team. You had that clip from the documentary in which Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman actually provided the dialogue for their puppets. And I hear Stephen Moffat actually gave you a hug in a LobbyCon a few days ago.
Yeah, I'd never met Stephen before, so that was kind of nice that, I saw him and I had the puppets out and I went up to him. And, he knew who I was. So that was pretty satisfying that I didn't have to remind him or anything. No, it was absolutely lovely. It's been a blast, and it's been a great honor to be embraced by the BBC. I mean, what we're doing is still not licensed. It's not sanctioned, but it's given a thumbs up, as it were.
Yes.
It's cool. I mean, and Dr. Puppet, it's a weird thing because it's a lot of effort to put into something that you don't own. It's someone else's IP. It's a very strange thing, and even I am perplexed every day, and I'm doing it, like, how it got this far, because, like, to back up the history of Dr. Puppet a bit, it didn't start huge. It was just one puppet. I made it because I really liked Matt Smith, and I needed to make a puppet as a demonstration for a class I was teaching. It's kind of a whole convoluted thing, but I ended up with a Matt Smith puppet. And I put photos on the internet of the puppet, and people liked it. And then I'm an animator. It's a stop motion puppet. Better animate it. So it's kind of baby steps. You know, you make a puppet, you make a short little thing, you make a slightly longer thing, and then oops, you've made an entire season of stop motion animation Doctor Who. You know, baby steps. So it's not like I never set out to make this thing, because it's a lot of effort to put into this. That this thing you can't own, you don't own, and the BBC could have not embraced it. But they did in the ways they can, you know. They can't fully endorse it, but they can give us a thumbs up, and then we'll keep making it, basically. So it's been wonderful, and it's really great to know that the people who work on the show watch.
So what have been sort of the challenges of having this passion project hobby blow up the way that it has? Because it's you know, a small passion that, you know, you spend a few hours on, and then it's a huge part of your life.
I mean, the hardest thing, honestly, was just keep making it. I mean, it's a huge amount of work. And the first year, we kind of had, you know, a lot of, you know, we were fresh and young. And, you know, this was 5 years ago. We were able to, in the first year of Dr. Puppet, put out 6 videos, which, looking back, it's blows my mind. I don't know how we did that. I wrote this script with these multiple, you know, this one story told over multiple parts, very like classic Who style. And we put out the first 5 chapters of that script in the first year. You know, and the original plan was to put out all the chapters in the first year, but we only got 5 out of 8. And then that was 5 years ago. And the next 4 years it's taken us that long to make the next 3. So the hardest thing was really just, you know, the finding the motivation to keep going, because it's so much work. And also we kept challenging ourselves, and that's really our fault. The first 5 were pretty easy to get done because they were very, very simple. Right. Every episode got progressively longer and more complicated. It's very like Harry Potter style, as it were.
Yes.
So we are on the Deathly Hallows, and it is so complicated. You know, this is the episode that requires a 2-part movie, as it were.
Yes.
We are working on it. It's episode 8. It's called The 12th Planet. So we are in the middle of working on that. We've been working on it for almost 2 years, sorry to say. But it is the finale of that story, so it is very complicated. It's clocking in at around 9 minutes.
Wow.
So going back to that 12 frames for 1 second, so you can imagine how long it takes to make 9 minutes. So
yes.
That's why it's taking 2 years. It's also just stupidly complicated. Even for Dr. Puppet, there's a very specific number of puppets in it, if you can guess, maybe.
Yes.
And a lot of sets. So it's really the ultimate Doctor Who episode, kind of, in a way.
Yeah. So then it sounds like we might have some fun stuff in store for puppet number 13.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm looking at it right now. And still, you know, honestly, I made the puppet. Don't have any other plans with her right now. So I do not know what we're doing with her. You know, there's only so far ahead I can plan. So we're still, the funny thing is, we're still working on the 11th Doctor's story in Doctor Puppet World, because it's taken that long. So I don't know what we're doing with 13. I'm just stopping. I'm at the end of my thoughts on 11. So
right,
Doctor Puppet World. The time is works differently than the rest of the Doctor Who universe. So
it's a little wibbly wobbly.
It's a little wibbly wobbly. Exactly. We're just catching up. So I don't know what we'll do. Who knows?
Well, we look forward to seeing episode 8 and all of the other Dr. Puppet materials that we are just so lucky to get to see.
Oh, thank you so much.
Elisa, thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Time Travel.
Oh, so I'm so thrilled to be here. Seriously, this is amazing.
Good. We're here today with Rona Monroe, the award-winning playwright and writer of 2 Doctor Who stories. Rona, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about when you became a Doctor Who fan and sort of what role Doctor Who played in your life.
Oh, goodness. Well, my family, like a lot of families, watched it together right from William Hartnell. So I have a memory of a really early episode featuring William Hartnell and how utterly terrified I was. And of course, Stephen Moffat being an absolute encyclopedia of Doctor Who, I was able to tell the story of, you know, characters stumbling down a corridor and aging into decrepitude and then crumbling into dust. And he was able to kind of name and date the episode. And from that, I realised I was 3 years old. So that's my one of my very early memories is of being utterly terrified by Doctor Who.
So how did you come to write for Doctor Who when you wrote Survival?
I was quite a young writer and I had been doing a little bit of BBC radio and they had a like kind of workshop week for writers that they were trying to bring on to write for television. And I was attending that and there was various script editors and producers that were there to talk to us and possibly kind of engage us to write episodes. And Andrew Cartmell, who was the script editor of Doctor Who, was there, and he tells the anecdote a bit more brutally than I would, which is that he would, you know, people would come up to him and say, you know, who are you? And he'd say, oh, I'm the, you know, script editor for Doctor Who. And then they would just run away. Whereas I ran towards him and kind of went, oh, how do I get to write for Doctor Who? And it felt like that enthusiasm carried me into the commission, really. Though I think they probably did ask me a few more probing questions and get examples of scripts and all that kind of thing.
So it seemed like that program was pretty effective in helping you launch your TV writing career and getting you the gig with Doctor Who. Of course, getting more women writers involved with the program is still an issue today. You're one of six women who has ever written for the show.
Yeah.
Do you think that programs like that are especially effective in bringing in new women writers and helping them launch their careers?
I don't think there was any attempt in that program to prioritize getting women into writing. Though there were other women on it, but again, I think there was just myself and Winston Pinnock, another British writer. So I, if you're asking me in a broader sense whether I've benefited from positive discrimination, I definitely have. And I feel very strongly that you need, if any group has been excluded from the mainstream, a period of positive discrimination is essential, because it's not about, it's about creating role models, it's about creating experience. Until you're given the experience, you can't have the experience. So the counter argument, which is just, oh, everyone should just compete on their merits, whatever the field, doesn't hold water, because if you have no vision of yourself doing it, if you can't look around and see other women or other people of colour doing it, then, you know, you're not going to aspire to do it. If people are looking for, you know, writers or any profession to have experience before they go to a certain level, and experience isn't available to you, then you are never going to get over that hurdle. So I think, yeah, that there should be people consciously looking at where the gaps are, where are the people that are not being represented. Because when you're talking about storytelling, right, you're talking about human experience, and if only certain people's experience is ever told, then you're getting a very narrow vision of what humanity is, actually.
Yeah. And it seems like the basic argument against it's always been a meritocracy has been the fact that there aren't equal representation of people.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
So there was a gap between you writing Survival and then coming back to the new
series.
Just a little bit. So when the rumors first started coming out that they were going to bring in a writer from the classic series into the new series, a few of us immediately went, please be Rona. Please be Rona. But the immediate thing that we heard was, well, she's a serious, accomplished playwright now. She doesn't want to come back to Doctor Who. That was sort of the received wisdom everyone was getting of being worried that you wouldn't want to come back to write for Doctor Who. But it seems like you did really want to come back.
And I think it's also, there's this really weird idea that people that write theatre, or especially if you get to the point and you know, because I'd written for people like the Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theatre of Scotland, National Theatre UK. So it all sounds very prestigious, and there's a slightly artificial elitist idea in certain circles that you are therefore consider yourself a better type of artist or a purer type of artist, which is absolute rubbish. Number one, because theatre pays really badly, so everyone needs to do tele gigs. And number two, because populist entertainment, in inverted commas, is actually the most difficult thing to write, and the strength of storytelling you get in a popular series like Doctor Who is equal to anything Shakespeare was doing, and anyone who doesn't think that is a pretentious elitist and not offering an opinion that I subscribe to. So yeah, I was rabid keen to do it always.
I'd love for you to expand a little bit on what makes populist entertainment more difficult.
I think because I now this is personal opinion, and a lot of people would shout me down, but I think there is a trend in what are seen as the higher arts, in inverted commas, to almost make the difficulty of accessing them a virtue. Whereas if you look at, you know, great artists, acknowledged great artists of the past, you know, like someone like Leonardo da Vinci or Shakespeare or Bach, or they are not creating art that is inaccessible to any human being on the planet. And those are strong pieces of work. But to create a piece of art that can appeal to a mass of people without it being obvious or trite or generalised is extraordinarily difficult. So the very best of things like Doctor Who or the other series that we all love are actually, I would say, that the very best writing you could possibly ever do, because you have to not only write well, you have to reach that mass audience too, without compromising your own kind of moral worldview or individual creative worldview. And to combine all those things, that is the most difficult task of all. To write something that is challenging and a little bit obscure can be rewarding in other ways, but I would argue it's often easier. Which is not to say that I think all art should be universally accessible, but I would argue that great art always is accessible if you bring an audience to it. So, for instance, when you do have art that people see as elitist or obscure or inaccessible, it's often because they wouldn't think of visiting that art gallery or going into that theatre because they believe it's not for them. But if you actually get them in, they can see it. So I personally really strongly believe that great art should always be populist.
So you wrote originally for Survival, you came back to write for Eaters of Light, yeah, both of which are in very different eras of television, and working with different formats for sharing and telling Doctor Who. What was some of the challenges of writing for Doctor Who now, and what were some of the joys of working in a new television format?
You mean the comparison between the two?
Yes.
Or, so
yes.
What was better now than then? Or maybe what were the advantages of both?
What were the advantages and what, yeah, were some of the challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one, Survival, and I think I've been talking about that a bit this weekend, mm-hmm, on that last series, and I came in right in the last series, I think everyone already knew that the show was completely beleaguered and that the BBC basically wanted it to go away. So you had this sense of being quite defensive, but almost like a kind of glorious little band making a last stand before the bulldozers came and dragged us all away. So that was quite moving. And also it was a small team and no one was supervising the stories, which is funny because I'm going to go on and say what a plus that was on the new one. But there's also that joy of you just write it and they film it. And, you know, Andrew Cartmell was making sure it worked as Who, and the logistics of the science fiction elements worked, but you were very much, you know, kind of felt like you were pushing your own idea, and that was a joy. But the fact that the whole thing was closing down and you had no resources and no money, that was not so great. Coming to the new one, you had the wonderful experience, which was almost the direct opposite of what I said, of this team of people who were all passionate about Doctor Who, but who had turned into a global hit. And so therefore you had a lot more resources and a huge team of people to help you. And then also a lot more guidance on what the story should be. And funnily enough, that was a joy in another way, because then you felt you were feeding into this really strong series arc that someone else was taking care of. So in a sense, you could relax more and go, okay, they're going to keep their eye on that bit. and I can just do the really cool bit about Picts and, you know, strange monster that I've invented with, and the series elements, they'll just tell me. So that was actually quite relaxing. So they both were great in different ways.
And the monster that you had in Eaters of Light, that was the whole experience was based off a childhood experience of yours, exploring the Cairns up in Scotland.
Yeah, so on the myths and legends of of Scotland, the really early myths and legends and oral literature, I was very into all that, and the idea of people living inside these hollow hills, and you know, you read those stories, and the idea that they're a portal into another world, and that time distorts within them, is in all those stories. So I just kind of added bits and provided an explanation for bits of history that no one has an explanation for. So I could just appropriate them.
Yes. On a final note, I do want to say, as a queer woman, I very much enjoyed Survival's subtext, and I was even more excited to learn that the subtext wasn't just me, that it was intentional and meant to be there. And it was great that you were able to come into Eaters of Light and make, you know, subtext explicit, to have those conversations about queer sexualities openly up front without having to hide them. That was really just wonderful to see.
And it was Stephen who prompted me to, you know, put in the scene where the ancient Romans are kind of like confronting Bill and going, oh God, you're really restricted, you've got this very now, you know, and which of course is culturally accurate,
yes,
and a little window into the fact that we think history is that, you know, has the values that we have, and a lot of them, no, they had a far different attitude. But yeah, it was also lovely to see how far we've come. We sometimes think there is no progress and everything's getting worse, but every so often you get a reminder, and no, actually some battles we're inching a little bit forward, and that's brilliant.
It is. Well, Rona, thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Time Travel and for being here at Gallifrey One.
Thank you, lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Time Travel. We'll be back next week picking up where we left off on our review of The Doctors Over the Decades. It's time to talk about the most conservatively attired of all the Doctors, the Sixth Doctor, as played by Colin Baker.
You can find us online at thisweekintimetravel.com. We're also on Twitter at DrWhoThisWeek. Chip is on Twitter at @2MinuteTimeLord. And I'm on Twitter and Tumblr at Whovian Feminism.
You'll find us on Facebook as well. And, of course, on the Incomparable Network, where you can support our show by becoming a member and ticking the box for This Week in Time Travel and any other Incomparable shows you like at theincomparable.com/members. I misstated the title of our episode last week, but the announcement is true. We will be doing a future members-only special episode with some of our best friends in the Doctor Who podcasting world. Subscribers get more at Big Finish. At This Week in Time Travel. Thanks to Christopher Breen for our original theme music, to David J. Lohr for our original podcast artwork, and we'll see you next time. You'll be back on this coast, right, Alyssa?
I will be back on that coast. It's going to be so cold. Yay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.